Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Perhaps the biggest story coming out of the recent ASCO meeting in Chicago was the lead plenary presentation by Dr. Michael Nant, focusing on an Austrian trial in premenopausal patients with ER-positive breast cancer who received an LHRH agonist with either tamoxifen or anastrozole, with a secondary randomization to zoledronic acid given every 6 months for 3 years. The study demonstrated a stunning 35% reduction in relapse rate with the bisphosphonate, and I met with Dr. Nant to discuss this groundbreaking study. He began by reviewing the early evolution of the trial.
The story started with the endocrine question. And then we became concerned, okay, when we use the aromatase inhibitor, what's going to happen to bone? We need to protect bone. So then we came across the bisphosphonate and said, well, bisphosphonate may have anti-tumor. Let's try to have both questions in there.
So when you were thinking about it from powering point of view, you were thinking about that?
Yes. In fact, to be very correct, after our sub-study was reported for the first time in 2004, and I think that was when we did an interview about
this. Right, that was the first time.
We assembled an international advisory board and said, well, what are we going to do now? Because nobody knew, no approval of any of these drugs. So what should we do with the trial? Is it ethical to maintain a non-bisphosphonate group and all these kinds? And these
people, I guess at that point, what you were seeing was that the bisphosphonates totally reversed the bone problems with
yes.
the AIs and even tamoxifen, I think, right?
Yes. Yes, because in premenopausal patients, tamoxifen cannot completely protect bone from treatment-induced bone loss. What happened with these people, including, you know, distinguished bone specialists like Jean-Jacques Boudy and others, would say, well, you know, you guys, you now need to go ahead and really go at the anti-tumor question, and we are concerned that your sample size may not be good enough, which was 1,250 at that time. So with that, we decided that we would beef that up to 1,800. But from then, you know, it was clear that we would have the power to at least detect a major effect. In Austria, we do have a little bit different approach to adjuvant chemotherapy. We do believe, and I think firmly, I believe, and I have been able to show yesterday that this is actually probably the correct approach, that you can at least, those patients with highly endocrine-responsive tumors and low and intermediate overall risk, they can safely be treated without adjuvant chemotherapy. And that's building on a tradition of a previous trial, which was our trial 5, showing gozerolin plus tamoxifen as compared to CMF chemotherapy. So physicians in Austria and patients in Austria are willing, have been willing to go on a trial, and that's different from other countries like the US.
I remember when we first talked about this study, I was really amazed at the fraction of patients in Austria who go on study. What's the current, you know, of the patients that were theoretically you think are eligible for the
it's
study?
It's a little over one third.
A third.
So I would be pretty proud of that. And, you know, obviously such a result is being fueling back into the system in terms of creating enthusiasm. And obviously there is some, you know, national pride involved with having two presentations at this plenary session.
The other one being the long one.
The other one being the long one.
That's fascinating. Let's start to dissect out the trial and also the discussion by Martine Picard-Gebhardt afterwards. And there's a lot to talk about. And let's begin with what you just mentioned, the fact that really is very striking that these premenopausal women did not get chemotherapy. What was the eligibility specifically of the study and what kinds of patients actually ended up going into it?
Formally, the inclusion and exclusion criteria have been as follows: early stage breast cancer, endocrine responsive disease, that means estrogen receptor and or progesterone receptor positive tumors. There's not a single patient in the trial with negative or unknown receptors. And obviously, the trial was open to patients with node negative and node positive disease.
But I think, wasn't there a limit on the number of nodes?
Well, the formal limit was fewer than 10. In practice, what happened is that people would obviously suggest participation in this trial to patients with very few affected nodes. So the majority has one or two. So I don't think that we can reasonably say that this result may also be true for patients like with 8 involved nodes.
But what was the specific, for example, fraction node negative, fraction node positive?
Yeah, that was 30% node positive.
And they were generally up to 2,
yes,
3 nodes?
Yes, 1, 2, 3. So that's a selection. Clearly, in our trial, this is the low and intermediate risk group for premenopausal patients.
Now, I take it, and again, this is commented on by Martine, that you don't have HER2 for most of these?
Well, you know, in 1999, nobody did care about HER2. We now do have HER2 on many of these patients. We are going back to that and trying to investigate what happened to the HER2 overexpressing, because obviously they would also not get trastuzumab at that time. In the years after 2004, there was close to nobody with HER2 overexpression in the trial, because all these people would actually be offered chemo plus trastuzumab.
So your take was the vast majority of these are HER2 negative?
Yes, it's definitely less than 10%.
So this also would be the same population that nowadays, at least in the United States, a lot of people are using Oncotype on to try to decide whether to give chemotherapy or not. Just kind of curious as a side note, is that also being utilized or studied in Austria?
Not too popular, actually. It starts a little bit of discussion, but you know, I think there's two issues to that. One is whether a certain tool is useful or not depends on what are you doing without the tool. I mean, in my personal practice, you know, less than 50% of patients will have chemo if they are premenopausal. So what would be the additional use of using such an assay? So I'm probably not making as much use out of it as somebody US-based who would actually have been offering chemo to everybody. I mean, I can just quote Dr. Eric Weiner, who in the ASCO breast briefing said that he believes, and he, as I know, was one of the persons most concerned with our trial, whether that would be ethical or not. 3 years ago, he was giving me a hard time. And now he was actually, you know, very seriously saying, well, we may need to move away from that bias that everybody at young age just needs chemo. I mean, this is not really the scientific question of our trial now, but it's just a very good side effect. We observe, you know, that at 5 years, less than 2% of these patients have died.
I mean, that was what was shocking. I mean, in a sense, you were using ER as a marker,
yes,
not to use chemo. And I think, what is it, 5% recurrence at 5 years?
6%, yeah.
6% recurrence at five years.
It's pretty good.
Without chemo.
Pretty
including node-positive patients. I mean, it's kind
pretty
of amazing.
Good. And it's kind of difficult to theoretically improve beyond that with some chemo. And I mean, we have now been able to show that we improve by more than one third with the bisphosphonate, you know, without hair loss and without gastrointestinal side effects and so. But it comes down to patient selection. Obviously, you know, I'm not anti-chemo. If somebody has a certain risk and a certain, obviously, also response chance that she may benefit from chemo, then obviously I would be the first to suggest chemo to such a patient.
But I mean, somehow, you know, your investigators are able to pick out people who just with hormonal therapy alone, even without the bisphosphonate,
yeah,
had a pretty low recurrence rate. So I never realized it wasn't the point of the trial, but it was very striking. And I think it also gets into the issue again that Dr. Picard brought up in terms of events and how sure we can be about what's going on here. So let's go through again the numbers in terms of what you saw.
At 5 years of follow-up, we're now observing 137 disease-free survival events. And obviously, that good prognosis is wonderful for our patients. It's not so good for trialists. But still, I think that's a mature trial. It's 1,800 patients. It's 6 to 7% of patients haven't experienced any event. It's 5 years of follow-up. So I don't see any of these results going to change in the future. There was a comment made that the trial is underpowered to rule out any benefit in the endocrine question, because what we did show was that anastrozole and tamoxifen basically yielded identical results.
So that was in the face of an LHRH agonist, obviously.
Yes.
And one of the issues that, again, that Dr. Picard brought up was the efficacy of ovarian suppression with LHRH agonists. Did you look at that?
Well, you know, only clinically. And clinically, none of our patients was menstruating during treatment. So I agree with Martin that some patients may have a more effective estradiol suppression than others. But in terms of the clinical relevance for daily clinical practice, I think it's well accepted that ovarian suppression works with these LHRH agonists.
Again, side issue, Q month, I assume, versus Q3 month?
1 month.
Which agent?
Goserelin.
Again, sort of side question that's,
yeah,
kind of come up a little bit. What about the issue of Q3-month LHRH agonists?
You know, as a scientist, I would like to confine my conclusions on the work we've actually done and on the data. It is known that the Q3-month agents have a tendency, at least in some patients, to lose efficacy at the end of that quarter. So I would personally feel more comfortable with a 28-day schedule. But, you know, there will be other trials with 3-month agents.
So can you talk specifically about the numbers in terms of what you saw, both in terms of the endocrine question as well as the bisphosphonate question?
For the endocrine question, basically there was no difference in disease for survival, recurrence for survival, or overall survival. between anastrozole and tamoxifen in the presence of ovarian suppression. I mean, these curves are virtually overlapping.
Now, in terms of this endocrine question, yeah. I mean, do you feel confident enough in what you found to be uncomfortable, theoretically, putting a patient on a study right now? How do you think it affects the studies? I mean, there are obviously studies out there looking at this question.
Well, I think there are several levels of what the clinical consequences of scientific results are. That may be that we say, well, okay, now we have defined a new option. We may have defined a new standard, and we may have interfered with other standard treatments. I don't think that we should take this to that level. Our trial is, in terms of numbers, borderline to completely and definitely rule out any AI effect in premenopausal patients. So I think it's prudent to wait for these other results. I would encourage both patients and physicians to consider participation in these trials. There is no overall survival or toxicity, serious toxicity concerns in doing that, and I really think that we need some additional information on that. Having said that, I would on the other side think that, you know, you cannot just say it's underpowered and it's going to change completely. So I would not think that the overall picture is changing considerably. And for the endocrine question, I mean, clearly the glass is either viewed as half full or half empty. You can say, well, you know, it's disappointing that we didn't see a benefit for the aromatase inhibitor. On the other side, you can see it's reassuring that basically it is as good as tamoxifen, and it obviously has a favorable side effect profile, particularly with respect to thrombosis and then endometrial changes.
And you saw that in your study, too.
Yes, we saw that. That's a significant difference. And that may actually offer patients just choices and in any way encourage participation in clinical trials.
You know, the other sort of, I wouldn't say hidden message, but something that struck me was that obviously all these women got ovarian ablation. Yeah. And, you know, that certainly is not a standard of care, at least in the United States right now. And I guess I was looking at those numbers and, again, particularly those very low recurrence rates, even without the zoledronate, and wondering, does this kind of imply, even though you didn't have a tamoxifen-only arm, that, you know, maybe that should be the way to go?
Well, you know, the combination of glucosylceramide and tamoxifen is considered a potential standard of care, an option. That's how it's quoted in all the guidelines and consensuses.
Although I don't think it's used that much in the United States.
It's not too popular in the United States.
I think more in Europe.
Yes, I agree with that. And there has been a meta-analysis of all these trials by an international group coordinated by Jack Cusick, published in The Lancet last May, showing that the addition of LHRH to tamoxifen, example, may have a borderline additional benefit. It's kind of very complex to dissect these different benefits between chemo plus TAM plus minus ovarian suppression. Personally, my experience also as a doctor is that this treatment is very well tolerated. There are issues, obviously, around the side effects, which you need to discuss with your patients, but clearly for low-risk patients with highly endocrine-responsive disease, to me, that's still the way to go.
And I can tell you from our patterns of care studies that we do in U.S.-based physicians that clearly the most common hormonal therapy in premenopausal women in the United States is tamoxifen, period, at least to start with.
Yeah, and I know that some of our colleagues would actually start with tamoxifen, and if it doesn't suppress enough, then they would add probably some, which may be a good idea. But, you know, we have not enough information on these trials. And I mean, there are also in the U.S., there are researchers who do quite a lot of work, like Nancy Davidson and others, Hope Rigaud on the West Coast, doing elegant studies. And I think we just need to pay attention to this, that for the low-risk part of the population, and that's actually more than 50% of all breast cancer patients at that age, that is really an option that may need more attention than it had so far in the U.S.
Now, in a non-protocol setting, how do you bring in the question of taking out the ovaries as opposed to putting somebody, in your case it was 3 years,
yes,
putting somebody on LHRH agonist?
Well, you know, such radicality in terms of definite measures is something which probably in the Western world is not too popular. I know that in Asia, for example, this is done quite a lot. It's obviously cost-effective for women who have finalized their family planning. That may be actually an option, as well as for women with a certain risk of inherited breast cancer. That may be actually even preventive, very successful preventive approach. So I'm not saying that this is not the way to go. I'm just saying that's nothing I would offer to a 25-year-old woman right now, because, you know, my office, I have quite a number of photographs of post-treatment kids that my patients got, and I like that idea that we can restore also the social and sexual ability of our patients once they have been cured, hopefully, from breast cancer. But if, you know, for a 49-year-old, when we say, well, you know, I don't want to mess around with this, I'm going to be in natural menopause after treatment anyway, so please, let's get rid of all that risk of ovarian cancer and everything, you know, that's something which I completely understand.
Another issue about this question of endocrine therapy is, would you have seen a difference if you'd use another AI? Obviously, I think the tech studies using exemestane, but the question of, quote, a more powerful AI, I guess, letrozole as opposed to anastrozole. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, clearly the result we can talk about is confined to anastrozole. And I would have trouble speculating too much. There are reports that letrozole is actually a little bit more effective in terms of reducing numerically the estradiol level. Personally, I would have my doubt whether that is of relevance. If we bring down the estradiol by, let's say, 96% just with the goserelin, then 97% with tamoxifen, 98% with anastrozole, and then maybe 98.5% with letrozole, there is a chance that that's not going to make a clinical difference.
You know, one of the most debated questions up to this point has been, what do you do with a patient who starts out on tamoxifen, either with or without an LHRH agonist, gets to the five-year point, who's a premenopausal patient, obviously, what do you do at that point? We saw the provocative data in terms of ATLAS, looking at more than 5 years of tamoxifen at the San Antonio meeting, and the ATOM data. Can you talk about what they saw there, and then this question of what do you do when they get to five years?
If I got that correct, then they saw a late diversion of the curves and suffering heavily from lack of information on side effects.
Right.
So I don't think we really can use tamoxifen for longer than 5 years at this point.
Well, the other question is, and what a lot of people do, is particularly in the patients who don't get an LHRH agonist but stop menstruating either spontaneously or because of chemo, and if they stay that way and if they're chemically postmenopausal, when they get to 5 years, switch into an AI. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, that's what I do with my patients. In fact, I put them on a trial. I suggest a trial to them. We do have a trial of 2 additional years of an AI versus 5 additional years of an AI.
Which AI?
That's anastrozole in that case. And there are other trials open, like the SOLE trial with intermittent letrozole and the drug holiday, and again, intermittent, which is another very interesting concept. Most physicians would probably, outside clinical trials, counsel their patients in a way regarding the initial risk profile. MS-17 has clearly shown that the survival benefit is obviously most pronounced for those with node positive disease and at higher risk. I believe that we are entering an era where, at least for endocrine-responsive low-risk breast cancer, we are going to talk about a chronic disease. That means long-term risk and, consequently, long-term treatment as well. Unfortunately, as of yet, nobody knows how long that should be and what the patient selection should be all about. In any case, I think we should remind our colleagues that using an AI, particularly in perimenopausal women, has a certain clinical concern, is that it may induce ovulation in borderline endocrine status. So one should check, even in the absence of menstruations, on the hormone levels in, for example, a 55-year-old woman.
Yeah, and you know, I really hear oncologists agonize about this decision. Actually, we did a survey recently. We asked them to rank the importance and frequency of 20 different clinical scenarios in terms of how often they see it and how much they want more information about it. And the number one issue was premenopausal ER-positive patients. There's a lot of agonizing about whether their patient is staying postmenopausal. As you mentioned, you know, they get blood levels. I just wonder, you know, in those problematic patients like that, whether at least it's an alternative, you know, laparoscopic oophorectomy to at least discuss with the patient.
I would personally feel that that's a good idea to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about the zoledronate part of the study. And first, if you can talk a little bit about the dose and schedule, and then what you saw.
Overall, in the trial, we used 4 milligrams of zoledronic acid every 6 months. That's a total of 7 infusions over 3 years. We started initially in the trial with a higher dose of 8 milligrams monthly, but we were kind of forced for safety concerns. In the year 2000, there were reports that the renal safety was endangered in some patients with multiple myeloma back then, and basically all the trials around the world reduced the doses to 4 milligrams, and we went back to what we believed back then would be mostly a bone protection dose. And it's even more striking that we are not only protecting bone, we've shown that before, but that we also providing benefit in terms of keeping the cancer away. There are two more things that are actually really exciting. One is the magnitude of the effect. 36% reduction in disease-free survival, translating into at least a non-significant trend towards better overall survival in a 40% reduction. That's an accomplishment that usually you can utilize based upon like taxane chemotherapy. All of that with a very acceptable side effect profile, but which to me, in terms of a paradigm shift, is even more important that, and that came, I have to admit, as a surprise to basically everybody. We're not only beneficially impacting on the prevention of bone metastases, but we have been seeing this benefit in all kinds of event subcategories, including local regional recurrence, contralateral breast cancer, distant metastases outside bone, like liver or lung disease. And that's something which probably most of us would not have expected.
And again, Dr. Gebhardt talked about what she called the seed and soil, I guess, concept of what might be going on here. Can you talk about that?
I think that that was a very elegant and thoughtful comment about this, and that may be indicating the paradigm shift. I mean, that seed and soil hypothesis is more than 100 years old, and what it describes is that in order to effectively interfere with progression of malignant diseases, it would be ideal both to target the tumor cell and to attack the killer itself, but on the other hand, also try to beneficially, in terms of tumor cell, adversely affect the environment, the soil, so to inhibit that these cells can actually adhere somewhere and invade tissues and grow and find conditions where they develop into the deadly disease that they are, unfortunately, many of our patients. And nowadays, I think we have learned that this is at least equally important than directly killing tumor cells, particularly in an adjuvant treatment setting. We all basically rely upon the concept of dormant micrometastases sitting somewhere, basically waiting to wake up and killing our patients eventually. So that means that these cells might not be sensitive towards our anti-tumor directed treatments at that moment because they are kind of sleeping, so to speak, biologically not active, and therefore we would just miss them with an only anti-tumor-directed approach. If we now can create a tumor cell hostile environment, and that's what I believe happens with zoledronic acid treatment, basically to stay in this simplifying comparison, the dormant then wakes up, finds something which is adverse, and decides to go into apoptosis, then it may theoretically just be good enough to do that once to keep our patient healthy. Bisphosphonates and zoledronic acid has been shown to be the most potent one, have been preclinically shown to exert a variety of these mechanisms.
So, for example, when we talk about the soil and bisphosphonates, I assume it's just the bone, or is it possible they affect other locations or tissues?
I think that that's probably the most discussed point over the last 24 hours in the scientific community, because it comes as a surprise, and it's kind of a little bit difficult to envision how...
What's a surprise, though?
Well, that outside bone, we see those effects.
Oh.
And, you know, that's perfectly
that's
in line.
That's been seen before, hasn't it?
Well, early results from the SOFAST CFAS trial indicate that. I have heard yesterday that there is some neoadjuvant data coming out of the ASSURE trial showing that it may even be effective with a primary tumor in place. And it's kind of difficult to envision that maybe the bone marrow system acts as a repository for these cells and they may wander back and forth between these sites. But again, this is completely speculative at this point.
So again, in terms of the seed, what do we know about bisphosphonates in terms of direct effects on tumor cells?
Bisphosphonates have been shown previously, and particularly zoledronic acid, to interfere with tumor cell growth. They inhibit proliferation. They interfere with adhesion of tumor cells as well as with tumor cell invasion. they also induce apoptosis in tumor cells. The difficulty with this is that some of these laboratory or animal data have used bisphosphonate at doses which are, you know, not comparable to what we can do in a clinical setting. And therefore, I think this fuels the idea that it may not be a direct toxic effect on tumors, but rather on the environment these tumor cells are in.
And I guess another question would be, I was thinking about there's the agent denosumab, the RANK ligand inhibitor. Mm-hmm. Any evidence with that agent, or what would you speculate in terms of that agent in terms of the kind of effect you saw here with the bisphosphonate?
Very good questions. In fact, this morning I had a discussion about denosumab. The agent has been shown to be effective in treating bone disease. Obviously, there's also increasing data about protecting bone, and that's a very targeted, very smart way of interfering with that.
And it's fundamentally different than a bisphosphonate.
Completely different, and obviously, you know, I cannot comment on it other than, again, speculate. If that theory is true, that we can, with a bisphosphonate, in addition to any cytotoxic effect of that, a tumor cell-directed effect, positively impact on the microenvironment in bone, then I think there would be at least the perspective that denosumab can also do this. But obviously, currently, there's almost no data on this. And I think it's right now, many people are considering how those ideas could be exploited and translated into clinical research, and that's good.
Now, what about side effects, and specifically ONJ? And you actually made a comment about that there were three cases of suspected ONJ. What did you actually see?
You know, when we started the trial in 1999, nobody knew what ONJ would be. So basically what we did when the first reports came out is that we underwent some effort to educate physicians and patients on the trial, say, well, you know, raise awareness, be careful with your dental procedures, report symptoms early, and all that kind of things. It's an academic trial, so I cannot perfectly rule out that among our 904 sulfuric acid patients, there may be some case of ONJ which was not reported. We were able to identify three suspected cases, and in those three, we have been able to go back to the original dental films, and basically there was not a single case of confirmed ONJ. This is pretty much in line about what is known about that dose and frequency of administration of hyaluronic acid. So basically all the reports about ONJ with IV bisphosphonates are at more intense or higher dose schedules. So I would say it's just fair to say that ONJ is not a problem in the adjuvant treatment.
Or with this dose and schedule.
Yes.
I'm just kind of curious. I've been fairly fascinated by the whole ONJ thing. What was going on with those patients? Did they have ulcerations? And, you know, sort of what happened there?
Yeah, you know, we have a side effect category that is coded in the MedDRA code by periodontal disease, and that's basically spanning from all kinds of gum problems until, I don't know, prolonged healing after. So that was basically how we tried to track down potential ONJ cases. Again, there is no systematic evaluation with everybody being at the dentist for 6 months because, again, the problem was not known before. But I would expect that at least, you know, any major effect we would have seen just by self-reporting of patients. Meanwhile, that everybody was frantically looking for that condition. And in other trials, like the SOFAST CFAST trial in postmenopause, they did not observe ONJ either at that particular dose and regimen. This may be different in more intensified schedules like Rob Coleman is using in the ASSURE trial. I think they do have a few cases of ONJ. They start with a monthly dose and then quarterly and then end up with a 6-monthly for 3 years. So it may be related to dose and intensity.
Yeah, I actually interviewed Robert Marks, who was one of the oral surgeons who was involved in sort of discovering or identifying this. And again, just sort of a practical clinical issue. I mean, he makes the recommendation that patients who go on bisphosphonates should see a dentist first, just to sort of check out, make sure they don't have any major problems. Is that what you actually do? Or
yes.
Really?
Yes, that's
everybody?
Yes, I would support that recommendation. Obviously, if you have a patient treated for bone disease already for 24 months and she's fine and you're entering the third year, you would be more concerned than an adjuvant setting. You know, we fortunately live in a country where usually oral hygiene is good and the general health status of the population as well. These are also factors interfering with the frequency of ONJ. But still, I think it's prudent to have not oncologists looking around in mouths without knowledge, but having a dental exam for everybody.
So I guess the big question that comes out of your study, probably the biggest question that's coming out of the ASCO meeting, I think, although your other Austrian question about cetuximab and lung cancer is right up there, but is this ready for prime time? Is it ready for non-protocol therapy? Martine was somewhat cautious and said, you know, maybe we need to wait for another study before actually doing this off study. I don't know. I looked at those data and put myself in the position of a doctor and patient and said, it looks pretty tempting to try doing it now.
Well, you know, I think that there's two sides of that answer. As a scientist, I obviously would like to have confirmation for everything I do. I would also recommend that at least for now, the application of these results needs to be confined to the population where they were derived from. So we should be careful in extrapolating that to other patient populations like receptor negative disease.
Careful as in not do it?
Probably for now, particularly in view of that we are going to have this data pretty soon. I mean, SU is going to report probably by the end of this year in San Antonio.
And what study, what exactly
is it? The SU study is a study in particularly the complementary risk group of breast cancer patients, node positive disease, everybody in there together with chemotherapy for the majority of patients. So basically,
ER negative and positive?
Yes, at least 20% ER negative, if I'm correct. So that means it's just several months more until we basically know the whole story.
And what's the bisphosphonate?
It's hyaluronic acid.
Same
as well.
Schedule and doses?
No, a little bit more intense. So they started with a monthly application for 6 months and then quarterly up to 2 years and then 6 months up to 5 years, if I'm correct. Rob Coleman from the UK is the PI. They have recruited 3,300 patients, and they are going to have their first analysis in September. And everybody expects them, including themselves and myself, to report in San Antonio. So, I mean, that's the scientific answer. I think it's prudent to be conservative. On the other side, as a doctor and as a person, you know, I mean, quite frankly, if my sister were diagnosed next week, and she were premenopausal endocrine responsive. And obviously, we don't have approval for any of these currently, so there may be an availability and reimbursement issues. And she looks at the treatment and says, well, you know, that's 7 infusions of 15 minutes time over the course of 3 years. It's pretty well tolerated. The toxicity is low or either non-existing, well-defined what to look for. Already proven effect in protecting bone against the side effects of endocrine treatment and now shown to keep the cancer away by an additional 1/3, let me get that. And, you know, I would struggle in having an argument, say, well, wait for approval, wait for another 12 months.
So I suppose it was your older sister and she was postmenopausal.
Well, then it's a little bit more difficult. I would try to stay disciplined and say, well, okay, we're going to know this 6 months from now. We can probably start the bisphosphonate in 6 months as well to exert a positive effect, so let's wait for now.
And I guess the other, I saw some of my NSABP colleagues, and of course we have there, I think it's the B34 cladrinate
yes.
adjuvant study. I don't know how close that is to reporting.
As far as I'm aware, the recruitment is finalized.
And yeah,
they are
it's finalized.
In follow-up, but they are suffering in brackets from low events,
right,
which is great
you, yeah,
to our patients.
Exactly. That's been the issue with that study for a long
and
time.
And I think that's a very important study because obviously one of the questions is, well, you know, that's now hyaluronic acid. There are some issues around IV versus oral. Many patients take oral bisphosphonates for osteoporosis. Can they hope that there may be similar effects? It's very important that that's clarified. So also there's a CLGB trial.
Right.
And I would encourage actually them to continue that. And I've discussed the other day with Julie Grallo and other colleagues and said, well, you guys go ahead. I mean, it's not unethical currently.
Now, that study is comparing zoledronic acid, cladrinate,
and ibandronate, and they may change, as I hear rumors, the design a little bit, but, you know, it's very good that now that we have many indications, and the Austrian trial probably being the strongest one in terms of a mature trial, large-scale trial, but from other trials, there's also indications. These trials have not been powered to show this because they were bone protection trials. They may suffer from, you know, not enough follow-up or something like that, but still everything points towards the same direction, so it's very important that we keep these trials alive.
And that, you know, it's kind of interesting. I haven't seen Julie since you presented those data, but I remember when I talked to her, the thinking was, well, probably the NSABP trial is going to be positive for cladrinate, So we're going to try to get ahead of the game by looking at these other two agents. And yet, ironically or interestingly, it was your study that reported first.
You know, the reason for this is probably something like luck. Also, we were the only ones who in the initial calculation were kind of aiming at disease-free survival in all. So it's not only bone metastasis.
Right.
And that turned out true. It could have gone the other way around, and we would be left with a non-significant trend or something and no result whatsoever. I think that's how it goes in clinical research. Sometimes you are kind of lucky. With the endocrine questions, we may have hoped for more. The most important issue, obviously, is that we have been able to show that there is additional benefit in the magnitude of taxane chemotherapy being added with a relatively simple, relatively easy accessible, and relatively non-toxic treatment, which is just great information. And it obviously, as always, we find one answer and we ask several new questions. But I'm glad and excited, actually, that we came so far. And I think that's the most exciting thing about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's really refreshing. You know, you think that you've heard everything you can hear about management of the ER-positive patient. And something really comes out that's striking.
It's kind of a really additional payback to our patients. I mean, these are the true heroes. Still, we have a good endocrine tradition in Austria, but they have been willing to participate in a trial without adjuvant chemotherapy, which is against mainstream, clearly, particularly at that time. And it just feels very good. You know, that's work of several hundred people, several thousand patients over a decade or so, and now I'm just basically the coordinator of this, but it's really many people involved, and it just feels good that we can give something back to them. And to our patients, I mean, we give back 98% over survival, more than that at 5 years, and that just feels great.
And I guess maybe that's another kind of lesson from this study in terms of what you as a country were able to accomplish here.
Well, yeah, we are proud of that. It's not too easy to keep that up, but we are doing pretty fine, and we have been able to serve also as an example for some of our neighbors. The Germans are doing pretty well, and meanwhile, you know, I mean, if we join forces basically on a supranational and sometimes even global level, you know, we can basically answer all of these questions within 6 months. We just need to sit down and find the best way to develop these trials, which is not too easy in the bureaucratic world we all live in.